Travelling friends, it's Sarah the Tudor Travel Guide back as ever for this month's episode of the Tudor Travel Show. It's wonderful to have you here with me again. Now, we're going to very shortly dive into the subject of today's show, which is all about Mary Howard. Now, there's a fascinating character, if ever there was one. And I'll tell you a little bit more about my connection with Mary Howard in a moment. But just before then, let me say a few words about this month's show and indeed where I should be as you're listening to this. So, like many places around the world who are all in various states of lockdown or lockdown easing, we in August, here in the UK, should indeed be easing lockdown, and that is going to be allowing me to get back out on the road, and I have a few podcast recordings lined up. In particular, I'll be heading to Bonny, Scotland, where I'm going to be visiting some of the principal locations associated with the life of Mary, Queen of Scots, and I hope to be doing some podcast recordings. Now, I say hope because it has been a difficult task to pin people down. As you may well be aware, the heritage sector had to furlough a great many number of their employees, and they are only now in the process of reopening various properties. So this is going to go close to the wire, but I'm hoping that in the second half of August, I'll be hitting the road, I'll be heading north, and I will be getting chance to record some podcasts. If I am successful in this endeavour, and please wish me luck, because I won't know until a week or so before I'm due to go, then I will be holding in September a Mary Queen of Scots bonanza on podcast. Now, I don't want to say any more at the moment because literally plans are still, despite my best efforts, up in the air. But if all goes according to plan, when we hit the road back in September, then I'm hoping to bring you weekly podcasts from different historic places and buildings associated with Mary, Queen of Scots. Okay, so that's my mission, should I choose to accept it. And as I say, wish me luck, folks. I will report back on social media through August, so you will get to find out whether I am being successful or not. And remember that I am on Instagram, and I often post from the road on Instagram. And I'm also on Facebook and Twitter. The links to all my social media pages are included in the description with every single episode of the Tudor Travel Show. Okay, well, that's it. There's no more announcements to be made. We are going to talk about Mary Howard. So I need to tell you a little story. When I was writing Le Temps Viendra, a novel of Anne Boleyn, I came across this wonderful diminutive 14-year-old emerging from the pages of history. Initially, as one of the principal ladies involved in the ceremony of Anne Boleyn being made Marquess of Pembroke in September 1532. And I quickly fell in love with this character. It was quite clear that in so many different ways that she was a bit at odds with the rest of her family. And she was a strong woman with a mind of her own. And if you know anything about Mary's story, you'll know she lived a very intriguing and eventful life. Now, some months ago, I was talking to Nikki Clark when I recorded the podcast about Kenning Hall. And it so happens that, of course, Kenning Hall was the country seat of the Howard family, and we touched on Mary Howard. And it turns out that Nikki is a bit of an expert on Mary Howard's life. So I had to invite Nikki back so we could just focus on this incredible woman. And with that, I'd like to introduce you once more to Nikki Clark, who is senior lecturer at the University of Chichester. Let's go straight over and pick up my conversation with Nikki and find out more about this incredible Tudor aristocratic lady. Hello, Nikki. Welcome back to the Tudor Travel Show.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's nice to be back.
Gosh, haven't the months flown since we were last talking about Kenninghall? I don't know where the time has gone.
Yeah, that's what lockdown does, I guess.
I guess it does. A lot of water under the bridge since we last spoke. Anyway, we are here to talk about, I suppose, a related topic in a way, and the fact that we're here at all today talking about it came out of our discussion around Kenninghall, which of course was one of the principal country seats of the Howard family. And as I said before I came into this interview to the listeners, I have a particular interest in Mary Howard, and I know you do too. So today it's all about Mary. So why don't we just dive in? And first of all, let me ask you, you know, there may be some people who don't know that much about Mary. She's not the most prominent member of the Tudor court. So maybe you can highlight who she was and maybe some of her key Tudor relations.
Yeah, absolutely. Mary Howard was the younger daughter of Thomas Howard, the third Duke of Norfolk, and his second wife, Elizabeth Stafford. That made her the granddaughter of Edward Stafford, Duke of Buckingham, who was executed in 1521. She's the sister of Henry Howard, who's often called the Poet Earl. He's the Earl of Surrey, and he was executed in 1547. She is the first cousin of Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard, Henry VIII's second and fifth wives, respectively. So she's pretty well connected. She married Henry VIII's illegitimate son, Henry Fitzroy, Duke of Richmond, which made her the king's daughter-in-law. And so that related her by marriage to the Tudor dynasty itself. So people like his niece, Margaret Douglas, who's the daughter of his older sister, Margaret, Queen of Scotland. Margaret Douglas is Mary Howard's best mate at court.
And then
Howard's as well. She's more distantly related to a lot of other courtier families, like the Sheltons, Francis Bryan, the rest of the Boleyns, and so on. It's a very incestuous place.
It is, isn't it? That's one thing I learned when writing my novel, trying to work out who was related to who. I very quickly realised everybody seemed to be related to everybody else. Anyway, so look, why are you so interested in her? I was saying a little bit before our interview about how she captured my attention, but what about you, Nikki?
I wrote about her in my book on the Howard women, which is called Gender, Family and Politics, Howard Women 1485 to 1558. It came out with OUP in 2018. Mm. And she was one of the girls I chose to write about, partly because she's a bit of a force of nature. Uh-huh. Unlike some of her other female relatives, especially her mother, she does serve in her cousin Anne Boleyn's household, and she's part of that whole crowd at court at that moment. She gets widowed unexpectedly in 1536 and then started a bit of a fight with her father-in-law, the king, over money, and eventually won. She manages to circumvent a second marriage when all the powerful men around her are trying to get her into a second marriage. She refuses and gets away with it. And then as the 1540s progress, she also starts to hold very different religious beliefs from some of her immediate family. Her father, the Duke of Norfolk, is known for having been a strong religious conservative, but Mary began to follow the Reformed faith. So I was interested in her because she did things a little bit differently to some of the rest of her family. And I was interested in the way that family worked at the Tudor court. We have this image of girls doing as their fathers tell them, and the whole family kind of arranged together as some kind of coherent political force. But that's not always the case.
I think that's what really intrigued me about her as well. I mean, you know, I didn't study her life per se, but it was very clear to me she was I love the fact that you use the word force of nature, because that's how she seemed to me as well. You know, she was a woman who knew her own mind, and the fact that she broke away from the religious beliefs held by, you know, the majority of her family and followed the Reformed faith, I thought was incredibly intriguing. So Maybe we could go back to the beginning and try and understand a little bit more about Mary's early life. Do we know much about it, where she was brought up and with who? And, you know, did she receive that classic humanist education that was starting to sort of burst forth at the beginning of the 16th century?
We don't know a huge amount about Mary's early days, as is so often the case with early modern women. We do know that she's born sometime in 1519. Mm-hmm. The same year as Catherine Willoughby, who later became Duchess of Suffolk, interestingly. We do have a few details about her birth that may or may not be true and are a little bit harrowing. So potential content warning here.
Oh dear, go for it.
Well, according to Mary's mother, Elizabeth Stafford, Elizabeth was physically assaulted by the Duke of Norfolk, her husband, during labour with Mary.
Oh my
God. So apparently, when she'd been in labour with Mary two nights in a day, he dragged her out of bed and ran the house by her hair and wounded her in the head with a dagger. So that's pleasant. Ooh. He wrote later to Wolsey specifically to deny this. Do I mean Wolsey or do I mean Cromwell? Possibly Cromwell by this point. Norfolk said that Elizabeth had put this story about just to slander him. He said that he could prove by witnesses that she'd had the scar in her head months before she gave birth to Mary, and that he thought no man would treat a woman in labour that way, and he would not have done so for all that he was worth. So we just don't know whether that is true, whether it's partly true, or what was going on really, but it does suggest that Mary's entry into the world wasn't necessarily smooth.
Oh, a really traumatic one. Because, of course, they didn't get on at all, did they, Norfolk and his second wife, is that right?
Second wife, yeah. No, not really, or not by that point. Although 1519 is usually thought to be too early for what we know of their marriage breakdown. Mm-hmm. Although perhaps not. It's difficult to chart. Yes, Norfolk took a mistress, Bess Holland, who worked in the household. And although this is not uncommon, Elizabeth hit the roof. She was not cool with this.
So where is that information? Because that's a really detailed account. Is that in letters and papers? Where do we find that?
It is, yeah. It's in letters and papers. I think it's a letter from Norfolk to Cromwell. I think it's calendared in December 1536-ish, but I'm not sure if we know the precise date. The original is in one of the Cotton manuscripts, and you can get at it on State Papers Online if you can get somewhere that has a subscription to that. Right. But yes, it's a letter from Norfolk to Cromwell.
Wow.
And it's interesting that he did write specifically to say, no, I didn't do that. Because domestic violence against your wife is not, you know, it's not illegal at this point. Mm. But usually, if accused of this, a man would justify it by saying it was correction for behaviour, and that sort of made it okay as long as he didn't go too far. So the fact that he explicitly denied it outright rather than saying, well, yeah, I did, but for this reason, you know, I don't often want to believe Norfolk, but I sort of do. We just don't know.
I was going to ask you, where were you sitting on this? What was your gut telling you? So, yes, I mean, he's not a particularly pleasant man. He's not somebody you particularly warm to. But in this occasion, you think he may have been telling the truth.
Yeah, it's really hard to say. I mean, yes, Norfolk is not a pleasant man. He's a damn good soldier and he's not unused to violence. And there are other accusations of violence that Elizabeth makes later on that do have more of a ring of truth to them, so far as we can tell. But yeah, I take this one with a pinch of salt. It may be that something happened and she's exaggerated it, or I don't know.
You mentioned the year 1536. So this was quite a long time after Mary was born. Was this part of a divorce, kind of a messy divorce?
Kind of, yes. By this point, Elizabeth and Norfolk's marriage has properly, fully broken down. In 1534, he rode all night back home to Killinghall from the royal court, locked Elizabeth up in a room, took away her expensive jewels and her clothes, the things that mark her status, and then took her to a house in Redbourne in Hertfordshire, which is near the road north, and essentially left her there with a smaller retinue and a smaller income. And she sort of lived more or less under house arrest for the rest of Henry VIII's reign. And she writes a long stream of quite desperate sounding letters to Thomas Cromwell through the 1530s, trying to improve her situation. Mm. So this is obviously part of the kind of slanging match back and forth.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. Well, that was very interesting diversion. But let's return to Mary now. So we don't know too much about her very early life, but when did she first come to court?
She probably made the odd visits to court as a child. She would have spent most of her time in childhood in the family's houses in East Anglia, so Tendring Hall in Essex, Kenning Hall a bit later in Suffolk, probably Framlingham Castle after her grandfather's death in 1524. And she would have been there with her older sister Catherine, her brothers Henry and Thomas, at least for some of that time. We don't know anything about her education, really. We do know that her older brother Henry was well educated, but that's probably because he was part of her future husband Henry Fitzroy's household, and the two were educated together along humanist lines. The few letters that we have from Mary a bit later do show that she's able to read and write, which is usual for a noble woman at this point. There are sources that suggest she read scripture in English herself. She also had books dedicated to her, but she didn't write anything like that herself. It's also reasonable to suppose that she probably had some French, but beyond that we just don't know about her education, unfortunately. And she probably comes to court as a child here and there, but her first recorded appearance as being in service at court is not till September 1532, and that's when she attends Anne Boleyn when Anne is made Marquess of Pembroke. By that point, Mary is already betrothed to Henry Fitzroy and she's about 13 years old.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So, and that's where I got entangled with Mary when I was writing about Anne Boleyn. And I was curious about the relationship between the two women, because as you pointed out there, Mary was sort of very preeminent in the elevation, the ceremony that elevated Anne to Marquess of Pembroke. Obviously, she was an important person from an important family, but I kind of kept coming across her being around. What do we know of the relationship between Anne and Mary? Anything at all?
Really not a lot. It's normal for her to have entered court at about that age, 13-ish, early teens, as a maid of honour. That's a classic age for maid of honour ages. We don't know a lot about the relationship between the two women. We always want to get at this, the kind of the real person and the real relationship, but very often the kinds of sources that we have just don't allow us to do that. We do know that Mary later gave John Fox, the martyrologist, information and anecdotes about Anne that he used in his Book of Martyrs. For instance, information about Anne apparently always carrying money that she gave to the poor in alms everywhere she went. That anecdote came from Mary. And that does suggest at least that Mary has positive memories of Anne.
Yeah, but we simply don't know kind of whether Anne had an influence on her or her later kind of reformist beliefs.
We don't have any direct evidence, but it is entirely possible that Anne does influence Mary religiously. Anne is said to have been of a reformist leaning. Her household is the most likely place for Mary to have encountered those ideas. Anne supposedly kept an English Bible in her privy chamber for anybody to go and read, for instance. Mm. So this is something Mary would have found when she was there. It is also the case that Anne apparently arranged Mary's marriage for her before Mary came to her service.
Yes, tell us more about that, because that was one of my questions. How involved was Anne in, putting her forward as a potential wife for Henry Fitzroy? Because Mary was the the youngest daughter, wasn't she, I think, of the Duke of Norfolk. So not one of the, maybe the others were all married, I don't know, but I was intrigued about how all that came about. So what can you tell us about that?
It was a bit of a muddle, to be honest, partly due to plague. So yes, Mary is the younger daughter. She has an older sister, Catherine. That older sister was forgotten about by historians for many years because the records get a bit confused. Her older sister, Catherine, got married to the Earl of Derby in 1529. The Earl of Derby was still a minor at that point. He was under 21. So Norfolk had bought the last year of Derby's wardship. And then slightly illegally, or at least questionably, because he didn't get royal permission, he swiftly married him off to his oldest daughter, Catherine. And that is a really lucrative match for the Howards, politically, socially, and economically. So it's like, yeah, good, we got this, great. At that point, Mary was betrothed to the heir to the Earldom of Oxford, which again was a good match. Howards and De Veres had married before. But that betrothal got broken in 1529 when the king seemed favourable to her marrying Henry Fitzroy instead, which is a better match politically and socially.
Mm, right.
Her older sister, Catherine, who's married to the Earl of Derby, died very unexpectedly in March 1530, only a few weeks after marriage, of plague.
Ah, I see.
And I mean, this is no doubt devastating for her parents and for her whole family, but it also creates a political issue because that marriage that she had to the Earl of Derby was too valuable to lose. So as well as grieving the loss of their daughter, Norfolk and Elizabeth are immediately going, okay, but how can we hold on to this? Mm-hmm. And Mary's mother, Elizabeth, thinks the obvious choice is for Mary to take Catherine's place and marry Derby in her stead. But because there have been talks going on about her marrying Henry Fitzroy, Norfolk is keen to carry on with that. And Anne Boleyn gets involved. Anne is very keen to cement her own position in the royal family by creating other connections to the Tudors by marriage. If the Howard family is already part of the Tudor dynasty, then it bolsters Anne's own position because it looks less bizarre when she marries the king, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so she sticks her nose in and insists that Mary should marry Henry Fitzroy and not the Earl of Derby. Anne and Mary's mother, Elizabeth, seem to have a bit of a fight about it. High words are exchanged, and Elizabeth nearly gets dismissed from court, but Anne eventually gets her way. And Mary's mother, Elizabeth, later said that they didn't even have to pay any dowry because Anne got the marriage for them by persuading the king.
Aha. Uh-huh. Gosh, so that's an interesting relationship between Elizabeth and Anne as well. So they didn't get on so well?
No, they are not mates. Elizabeth has been a lady-in-waiting to Catherine of Aragon for 16-odd years, off and on.
So that's where her allegiance absolutely firmly lies. Yes, I can see some sparks may have flown there. But yes, Anne, of course, at this time was still very much in her ascendancy, wasn't she? So it's not surprising, really, that she probably got her way by wrapping the king round her little finger.
Yeah, I think so. And Anne is also, I think she's very anxious and she's quite afraid. Yes, she's in ascendancy, but it's by no means a done deal in 1529, 1530. So I think anything that she can do to help herself and help her own position, she's going to go for and woe betide anyone who gets in her way.
So when did they finally marry Henry Fitzroy and Mary? When and where? What do we know about that?
They marry in 1533. I'm not sure if we know where precisely. Mary herself probably didn't have much of a say in the matter. But I mean, we don't need to assume that she's doing it against her will either. Mm. Daughters mostly do want the same economic and social things that their parents want for them. Romantic love isn't usually considered part of the equation for aristocratic marriages, which does sound very sad to us, but just it isn't much of a thing. It marriages for other purposes. So we don't really know whether it's a good match temperamentally. It's really hard to know what they're like, especially because Fitzroy died so young. And they marry when they're still teenagers, you know, so it's hard to tell.
Yeah. And they didn't get a chance to live together, did they? Because obviously there were, because there were fears about, you know, Mary conceiving too early and obviously running into the perils of childbirth. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, they never did cohabit. Both of them were considered too young. So it's normal for marriages to be arranged or even formalised between teenagers because church law says that girls can get married at 12 and boys at 14. But generally by that time, it's thought to be a bad idea for them to actually crack on with married life and having sex and kids and so on. And yes, partly because they don't necessarily want 13-year-old girls giving birth. By this point, they've moved on a little from the Margaret Beaufort scenario. But it's also because they think it's bad for boys to be doing that too young, partly in memory of Prince Arthur, I think.
Ah, I see. Yes, of course. Yes, that would make a lot of sense. Yes. And Henry VIII obviously carrying the memory of the death of his mother from childbirth. And then that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Okay, so should we fast forward a little bit? Because Henry Fitzroy doesn't last too long, does he?
He does not.
What happens when he dies in 1536? What happens to Mary then?
Well, her life hadn't really changed much up to that point, except that she now had the title of Duchess of Richmond, and so she had status outside of being the Duke of Norfolk's daughter. But because they'd never lived together, they weren't supposed to do that till the age of 18. Mm. I think life for both of them had continued as it had before. So when Fitzroy died, it's really hard to know whether Mary was sad. I mean, possibly not all that sad. She knew him. But there's no surviving evidence that they had a very strong, close personal relationship. Mm. But yeah, he gets ill and he dies quite unexpectedly in July 1536. And we don't know what he dies of because we rarely do in this period. It's too difficult to diagnose at a 500-year distance. But it's safe to say people didn't expect him to do that. Mm. And this is yet another bad event in the year of awful events for Henry VIII. It's been a month or so since Anne Boleyn's execution. And it ties in with another event that involves Mary in a really interesting way. So July 1536 is the same month that Henry VIII's niece, Margaret Douglas's secret marriage to Lord Thomas Howard is discovered. And that's relevant because Mary and Margaret are best buddies.
Can you tell us a little bit more? Because I really don't know anything about that relationship. Can you tell me a little bit more about what do we know about when they became friends and whether any particular ties that bound them together?
We don't really know. I mean, probably not until the early 1530s, once both of them were at court. Margaret, I think, is a little older than Mary. Margaret is the daughter of Henry VIII's older sister, Margaret. Yeah, Margaret is Queen of Scotland, or was Queen of Scotland, and Margaret Douglas is her daughter. The two of them are in service to Anne Boleyn, and they, along with Mary Shelton, make a little trio of M's. But the whole crowd of them and some of the boys as well, Thomas Wyatt, people like that, Mary's brother, Henry, Earl of Surrey, the whole crowd are like the bright young things of the 1530s. Uh-huh. They're really sharp and witty and clever. Mm-hmm. And we know this because Mary owned a blank manuscript book that she used to pass around the whole circle for them to write their favourite poems into it, and sometimes original ones as well. And then they would annotate it and write banter to each other in the margins and things like that. And we know this because that manuscript still survives. It's called the Devonshire Manuscript, and it lives in the British Library. There's a whole wiki book of it online. Somebody has transcribed the whole lot and included discussion about the different handwritings, who they belong to, the links between everyone involved, and things like that. And it's an amazing source.
What an incredible source. Maybe if you could share the link with us, Nikki, and I can put that in the description associated with this podcast, because I'm sure people would love to go and see that for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Wow. No, and I'm among them, by the way.
So Mary's at the core of that, and literary historians have written about the kinds of poems that they use. They copy out things like Chaucer and so on, and what that says about transmission of culture at the royal court at that time, how women are so clearly in the middle of it and integral to it, not stuck out at the margins. Mary is in the middle of that.
Brilliant. I can just imagine it. It's so clear and vivid, these bright young things, you know, sort of taking the court by storm. It's wonderful. Let's take a break from that interview just for a moment. Because it is time, as ever, to head on over to the TTG News Desk and find out just what Tudor news has been breaking in the month of August.
Welcome to the August O'Clock News with your newsreader, Robert Cole. Here are the Tudor headlines for the month. Margaret Tudor, daughter of Henry VII, marries James IV of Scotland at Holyrood Abbey. Mary I makes a triumphant entrance to London as England's new queen. King Henry VIII wins a decisive victory over the French at Tetuan. And after an eventful life, Thomas Howard, 3rd Duke of Norfolk, dies at Kenning Hall in Norfolk. Good day. And now for our top story. Today is a day of celebration. Margaret Tudor, daughter of our illustrious King Henry VII, was joined in matrimony with King James IV of Scotland at Holyrood Abbey in Edinburgh this very day. While the proxy marriage took place at Richmond Palace over a year and a half ago, today saw the couple officially wed in the ancient and magnificent setting of Holyrood Abbey, adjacent to the palace of the same name. Again, we can cross over now to our roving reporter in Scotland, Adam Buchanan, for all the latest. So, Adam, it must be a jubilant atmosphere up there in Edinburgh. What can you tell us about today's events?
Oh, good day to you, Robert. Aye, all of Edinburgh seems to be celebrating the day. As you may be aware, some wondered if the King would remain a bachelor all his life. At 30 years of age, he's no snip of a lad anymore, and one can only imagine how pleased he must be with his 13-year-old bride. Of course, the English princess has been making her way slowly north from London since early July, having said goodbye to her family, including her father, at her grandmother's Northamptonshire home of Colley Weston on the 8th. The new Queen of Scotland arrived north of the border just 1 week ago, on the 1st of August. Since then, she has been richly feted and greatly honoured by His Majesty King James.
Well, Adam, what can you tell us about the royal couple and the ceremony today?
Well, Robert, it's quite clear that the King is much taken by the young Queen and has accorded her every degree of humility since her arrival here in Scotland. It has been quite striking that he has had matching outfits made for their wedding ceremony today. Both their Majesties look resplendent in white and gold damask, with the Queen's gown being lined with taffeta and trimmed with a crimson velvet. As you mentioned at the top of your report, Robert, the marriage itself took place in the ancient and venerated abbey here at Holyrood, founded by King David I in 1128. Throughout, the King insisted that all honour be shown to the Queen, that she knelt in front of the altar before he did, that she kissed the cross and the other holy relics before he did, and I understand that those who are part of the royal chamber, that at the wedding feast, which is taking place right now, the King is sitting out from beneath his canopy of estate, a deeply significant gesture of deference.
I suspect that there'll be great feasting going into the night, eh, Adam?
Aye, you can be assured of that. The young Queen seems much taken by the dancing, and there'll be plenty of music and a few glasses of the aqua vitae drunk easing the celebrations along. I might just join them myself.
Well, thank you, Adam, and many congratulations to the royal couple from all here at the TTG Newsroom. And on that joyful note, that concludes this month's TTG News Desk. We will return in September, but for now, it's back to the 21st century.
Ah, happy, happy times. And you know what? The more time I spend in Scotland, exploring its 16th century history, the more I become intrigued by Margaret Tudor, So don't be surprised, ladies and gentlemen, if you hear more about this lady, her life, and the places associated with her in forthcoming Tudor Travel Guide blogs, podcasts, etc. But for now, it's time to return to my interview with Nikki Clark. So let's pick up the story and take it to the end of Mary's life. But what happens then to Mary? Because she doesn't remarry, does she? But she does get embroiled in a few, as you hinted at the beginning of our discussion. Life doesn't get dull for her at this point at all.
No. So right before her husband dies in 1536, Margaret Douglas has a secret affair with Mary's half-uncle, although he's not much older than her. It's a bit of a complicated family tree. His name is Lord Thomas Howard. The only way that the couple can meet is in secret, otherwise they'd be noticed. But it is really hard to meet people secretly at court, so you need a helper. Mary is their helper. So she and Margaret wait until everyone else is out of the room, and then they'll let Thomas in. Mary is there when Margaret and Thomas marry secretly in Easter 1536. And she knows this is not technically a good idea. It is technically illegal. But, you know, Margaret's her mate. And hey, Margaret's marrying Howard, so that helps the Howard family out, right? I'm sure it's fine. Reader, it was not fine.
No. What next?
This gets discovered in July 1536, and the king is predictably furious. The big problem with this is that Anne Boleyn has literally just been executed. That means her daughter, Princess Elizabeth, has been illegitimized. So the king now has two illegitimate daughters and no son. The succession is not looking great. So for his niece to now go and marry some Howard younger son is not cool. But they can't legally undo it because church law upholds even clandestine marriages. So instead, the couple get imprisoned in the Tower and then Margaret's moved to Zion Abbey. Lord Thomas gets attainted for high treason. They spin some kind of charge saying, well, he was trying to get at the throne, obviously. Mm. He's not executed, but he does die in the Tower a year later, and Margaret remains in Zion Abbey for some time. Now, Mary should have got in some quite serious trouble for being their go-between, and the fact that she didn't is probably because at about that time, there are rumours that the king is about to make her husband, Henry Fitzroy, his heir to the throne. Now, he can't do that and simultaneously imprison his daughter-in-law without looking a bit daft. Right. Unfortunately, Fitzroy then dies very unexpectedly, slightly later that month. So that plan is scuppered. And by that point, it just seems to be that there's so much else going on that the will to do anything to Mary seems to have just disappeared. So she gets away with it.
Woo, that was lucky.
Yeah, yeah. So Fitzroy dies, and I'm sure the king is really grieving, but it's very difficult to know whether Mary is. It's hard to know how well she really knew him. What she does immediately is go back to her father's house at Kenninghall, because she doesn't really at this point have much else place to go. So by that point her mother isn't there anymore because her parents' marriage has broken down. So Mary is at Kenninghall with her brother's wife, her father's mistress, maybe also her youngest brother. Mm-hmm. And what happens next is a fight over money. Again, this is very Tudor. They like to do this. So normally aristocratic marriages are made with a kind of prenup agreement. So the bride brings a dowry with her, which is usually cash. And in return, the groom's family agree a number of estates and say that the income from those will be hers if she gets widowed, and that is called a jointure.
Right.
So Mary ought to be entitled to jointure from the king, who is her father-in-law. But we know that Henry doesn't like to pay money if he doesn't have to, and this jointure would have been about 1,000 marks a year, which is not a small sum. Mm. So he claims that he doesn't have to pay her anything because the marriage was never consummated. Now that sounds like a nice handy get out clause, but by law, he's wrong. And plenty of lawyers and clerics gradually start telling him so. And Mary is also not prepared to just give this up without a fight. She expects her father, the Duke of Norfolk, to fight her cause for her at court. She doesn't seem to appreciate that that's kind of tricky when you really don't want to annoy the king.
Yeah, that's a dangerous plan, isn't it, really?
Especially well, it is. Yeah, so a bit unfairly, she thinks he's just not doing his best for her.
Yeah.
And we know that he is trying, because every letter he writes to Thomas Cromwell over the next few years has a line about his daughter's cause in it. So he is trying, but nothing really happens. We know at this point that her father is nervous about her future. He complains that there's no one of decent status for her to marry next. And around the beginning of the Pilgrimage of Grace rebellion in the autumn of 1536, he expects that he's going to be sent north to deal with it pretty soon. Because when you have a rebellion, you need a Howard, because he's a very good soldier. Mm-hmm. And at that point, he writes to Thomas Cromwell that he's worried about leaving Mary behind, with the question unresolved, in case she should bestow herself other than I would she should. He's worried that she might run away and marry someone unsuitable. That is quite an admission of lack of patriarchal control right there.
You're right, yeah.
Yeah, I can't control my daughter. She might do what I don't want her to do. Really? You're going to tell the world that?
I know.
So,
I was just going to say also, I guess it's a statement of how headstrong Mary must have been at that stage that he could
that. Yeah, I think so. And it doesn't happen, but the fact that he fears that it might seems to say quite a lot, you know?
Yeah.
So she carries on consulting her own legal counsel. And then she starts emotionally blackmailing her father into letting her go to court to sue to the king herself. And he writes to Cromwell really anxiously in a tone of, I'm not sure if this is a good idea, but she's weeping and wailing and she won't shut up. And at the end of the letter, he said he'd never communicated with her in any serious matter. And he didn't expect to find her, as he does, too wise for a woman.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So what happens next?
Well, behind her back, Norfolk and Thomas Cromwell and the king cook up another plan. They realise that if they can marry her off again, then the question of that jointure can be quietly forgotten, because any finances of a widow's become her new husband's. And if they choose this new husband carefully, he will never pursue the matter, and so it can just die a quiet death. So they decide on Thomas Seymour, with his agreement. He is the younger brother of Edward Seymour and Jane Seymour, who is the next queen. So he's not a bad match, although they don't have the kind of the same level of status that the Howards do. But still, so Mary comes to court, and it's unclear exactly what happens, but it seems that they present her with this plan. She says no, I think not, and leaves and goes straight back to Kenninghall. And Norfolk is left embarrassed and having to apologise for her.
Do we know why she objected to Thomas Seymour?
No, not exactly. My guess would be that it's partly a status thing. He's a younger son, he has no title. She's just been Duchess of Richmond. Really? This is a step down, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's that. I think also, possibly she simply didn't want to remarry again at all, but particularly I think she wouldn't want to give up that fight over her jointure and just you know, let it die.
Go away quietly. Maybe could you answer a question for me? It's slightly aside from the topic of Mary per se, but at some point when I was researching one of the books I was writing, I came across this term, femme soul, which I understand to mean, a French term, I understand to mean when a woman had been widowed, she was then fairly independent and was able to have control over her kind of money and finances and so on and so forth. Is that right? Or can you tell us any more about the status of a woman after she'd been widowed and how it was maybe different to a married woman?
Yeah, that is right. The term femme soul, yes, is usually applied to a widowed woman. A little earlier in the 15th century, women could apply to be known legally as femme soul, because it meant that they didn't have to pay their husband's debts and the husband didn't have to pay hers. So it was useful for women in trades and things like that. Mm-hmm. But yes, for aristocratic women, when you're a married woman, you don't exist in the eyes of the law. And this is because of the legal doctrine of coverture. So when you marry, you become the possession of your husband, essentially. Your own identity becomes subsumed under his. Everything that you own, well, you don't own, it belongs to him, and you belong to him. That means that married women can't do things at law in their own names. So they can't bring a lawsuit or make a will or own or administer property and things like that. They have to get a man to act for them legally.
Mm-hmm.
But when widowed, suddenly you do exist in the eyes of the law, and you can do all those things in your own name as an independent entity. So in many ways, yes, widows have more power in that sense than wives do. And widows often have more economic power because of the jointure that they have got from their late husband.
So from a 21st century point of view, looking back at it, we could see why Mary, we'd probably empathise with why Mary didn't want to have a second husband. But maybe that's our 21st century eyes looking at it. I don't know.
No, I think there's definitely an element of that. I suspect she doesn't appreciate being so tightly controlled by the men around her, for all that she accepts that there's a degree of that, that that's going to be normal. It's not that she's a kind of proto-feminist or anything. But yeah, being a widow generally often is a better bet than being a wife.
In our story with Mary, because at some point, I mean, maybe I'm skipping too far ahead, so tell me if I am. I don't want to miss out any good gossip along the way, but at some point at the end of Henry VIII's reign, she gets involved very bizarrely with the downfall of her brother. I always find that very intriguing. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So she does win the jointure fight. In 1538, the king does cave in, give her estates to pay her jointure. So Mary wins that fight and she doesn't remarry.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, by the end of the reign, things get rather odd. Mary's brother Henry is arrested on a charge of treason, swiftly followed by her father, the Duke of Norfolk, in December 1546. In January 1547, her brother is executed, and the charge is of treason, but it's really odd. It's related to the heraldry that he'd been using. So he'd been using royal arms that he wasn't entitled to. And that gets quite bizarre and heraldically complex. And it's usually argued that, okay, that might be the case, but it's an excuse. And this is because you don't use royal arms you're not entitled to near the end of a reign when the king is very paranoid. Henry VIII is not in great health by this point. It's becoming obvious there's going to be a minority reign of Edward VI next. So everybody is shuffling into position for regency.
Mm.
In this atmosphere, Henry Howard had been walking around talking about how powerful his father was going to be in the next reign, and then using royal arms he wasn't entitled to. Now, if you're a very paranoid king, or indeed, if you're somebody who'd quite like to get the Howards out of the way, it's not difficult to persuade the king that this is a bid for the throne and they should really be locked up, you know. It's not a great move.
No. And I guess the Seymours, were they behind that? I imagine they had the most to gain from getting the Howards out of the way.
Yeah, among others, yes. The court is pretty divided over religion at this point.
Mm.
Norfolk is known as a staunch conservative. Mary and her brother, though, are known as reformers. So it's not 100% get the Conservatives out the way. But it is true that some of the other powerful reformers do want Norfolk out of the way. He is the real target here. Henry Howard is a kind of distraction.
Right. And so is she called to testify against him, or does she testify against her brother in some way? What are the details there?
Yeah, they get arrested. And the next step is always to get witness statements or testimonies. And those are known as depositions. And who else do you ask about somebody's heraldry but their family? Annoyingly, those depositions don't survive anymore. They got burned in the cotton fire in the 18th century. But they were seen in the 17th century by Lord Herbert of Cherbury, Henry VIII's first biographer, and he wrote about them. So we do have a sense of what they said, and there is some other evidence that tells us how this went. So a couple of days after the arrests, in December 1546, some of the king's commissioners, who Mary will have known, arrive at Kenninghall early in the morning, and they found Mary and the Duke's mistress, Bess Holland, only just got up and not yet dressed. So they've been sent to bring news of the arrests, to search the house and to question the people who were there. And Mary's reaction shows that she knew immediately that this was really serious. In their report, they describe her as sore perplexed, fumbling, and like to fall down. Mm. And the women are told they'd be questioned, advised to cooperate, and Mary very sensibly says, all right, I won't hide anything from you, especially if it be of weight, and that she would tell them everything as she remembered it. Because what else do you do in that situation, you know?
Quite, very sensible.
Yeah. She seems to have grasped pretty quickly that her father is the real target here, but she is asked about a lot of the stuff to do with her brother. Mm. So according to Cherbury, a key point of her deposition was the way she told the story of her father's second attempt to marry her to Sir Thomas Seymour in 1546, and her brother's reaction to that. She had declined that match again.
Right.
Apparently just because her fantasy would not serve to marry with him, which is fair. Surrey had apparently told her that instead of refusing outright, she should have prevaricated, used that time to get into the king's affections, become his mistress, and then bear as great a stroke about him as Madame d'Etampes doth about the French king. That's a pretty big deal. Surrey's apologists say that that's a sarcastic suggestion and that Mary shouldn't have taken him seriously. Because he's essentially suggesting, start sleeping with your father-in-law and that will really help the family. And to an early modern sensibility, that's incest.
Yeah, right.
It's weird to us, but it's incest to them. And so she, of course, is appalled.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it could have been a really flippant comment, couldn't it, by a kind of a young, you know, a young lad about court. But you really didn't have any room for such flippancy in the Tudor court.
Well, yes. And I think if she'd done anything other than express her disgust, questions might have been asked. You know, apparently she said that everyone should perish and she would cut her own throat rather than she would consent to such a villainy. Mm-hmm. Pretty strong statement.
Very.
She also said that she had recently quarrelled with her brother Surrey on religious grounds because he had discouraged her from going too far in reading the scriptures, which suggests to me that she's been reading them in English and he's not sure that's okay for women.
Okay, interesting. Very interesting.
On the basis of this, some historians have said that for that reason they hated each other and they were enemies and so on. I think that's going too far. I think obviously they're both passionate characters, and just because they quarrel sometimes doesn't necessarily mean that brother and sister hate one another, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, thank you for that, because I had read that and it just confused me because it just seemed so at odds with the earlier account and I didn't understand how that could have come about. But now I can see, you know, this is just a bit of a family disagreement over various things that were said, and Mary was doing the smart thing by just saying it as it happened, I guess.
I think what she is trying to do is get her father off. So she's trying to exonerate her father. Cherbury, who wrote about this deposition, said that she reported a lot of, you know, passionate words of her brother's, which weren't to his advantage, but she was trying really hard to clear her father.
I see. And do you think that she believed at that stage that her brother would be executed or could be executed? Or do you think she thought it wouldn't, you know, these charges wouldn't really stand, or they wouldn't be as serious, and actually I can therefore get away with maybe recounting some of these very honest conversations we've had and he'd still be okay, and at the same time maybe I can help my father?
Possibly, yeah, it's possible. It's really hard to say. I think as well that when you're questioned by the king's counsellors, it's not a very pleasant experience, and I think it's very difficult to keep your cool and not give them some kind of information under those conditions. I mean, cynically, there are reasons for her to try and protect her father. She is still a single widow. She seems, by this point, not to be very well off, despite having won the jointure fight. She continually sells land through the 1540s, and so if her father is executed, she would lose her source of financial support, she'd lose the house, and she might have to marry Thomas Seymour after all. So she does know on which side of the bread, you know, which side of the bread is buttered. She is also questioned directly about her brother's heraldry, because they're zeroing in on this. And she responds in quite vague terms. She thought that he had more than 7 rolls of arms, and that he had resumed the Stafford arms of their grandfather, and that the crown above them, in her judgment, looked like a close crown. And that's been taken as evidence of her complicity with the government in trying to destroy her father and brother. But, I mean, it's quite vague. Saying that something looked so in her judgment doesn't say that it was so.
Yes, indeed.
And I mean, Mary's descriptions of this, you know, she's not daft. She's a noble woman. She knows about heraldry. She could have been a lot more specific if she wanted to be. So I think she is trying to do her best to steer the best course through this. And possibly she recognises, I mean, she's in a really hard position. She recognises that she's not going to be able to save them all because Surrey has done enough stupid things, you know. So none of her descriptions of things that Surrey has said were used to convict him. They probably didn't help his case, but they don't form part of the final trial.
Right.
So it's not fair to say that she causes her brother's execution or that she's trying to do so, because there were also plenty of other depositions that do condemn him.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And there's a lot more nuance there, isn't there, than the first meets the eye. Her reactions under incredible pressure, very, very understandable. So her brother is executed. Her father, by the skin of his nose, gets away with it, only by the death of Henry VIII. What happens next to her? Because how much longer did she live? What happens after this episode?
Well, after this, she gets custody, or takes custody, of her nieces and nephews, her brother's children. She hires the reformer John Fox as their tutor, something Norfolk would have hated. Actually, the first thing he does when he's released in 1554 is to sack Fox. I'd really wish I'd been a fly on the wall for that conversation.
Yes.
And during this time, she petitions the council saying, well, look, if you want me to look after these kids, you need to give me the money to do so. But she also petitions the council a lot on her father's behalf. And he recognises this in his will later and says, look, leave her some money because she tried so hard to help me. So she doesn't just forget about him. The other thing she does through Edward's reign is really crack on with religious reform and with patronage in that regard. So she has John Fox, the famous martyrologist, in her household. She's also the patroness of John Bale, who's another reformist writer, and several others. And she seems to work with the printer Nicholas Day to print reformist texts and get, you know, the word out to people who can read in English. So she's a big part of that reformist circle of noble women doing this.
Yeah. And at the same time, you were saying she's looking after her nieces and nephews. So she's in charge now of the future Duke of Norfolk. Is that right?
She is, absolutely, yes. And some of her teaching, or Fox's teaching, does seem to kind of to go in and take root. Because Thomas Howard, 4th Duke of Norfolk, sometimes there's disagreement about his religion. But it's pretty clear that he is Protestant. Later on, he is not Catholic like his father was. So for all that the Howards are often assumed to all be Catholic, many of them are very strong Catholics. And to this day, the Howards are still Dukes of Norfolk and they are still Catholic. And that's a really strong part of their identity. But actually, during the Tudor century, it wasn't quite as clear cut. Not everybody followed that same path. And yes, she does seem to have encouraged the 4th Duke of Norfolk before he got there. to follow a reformist path.
Fascinating. Brilliant. So what about the end of Mary Howard then? Where did she die? Do we know from what? And where was she buried?
She dies at some point in or before 1555, probably in that year. We don't know exactly where, and we don't know exactly when. We only know she's died because some of her lands start to be parcelled off to other people. She doesn't leave a will, and that's really unusual for a widow in her position. So it suggests to me that her death was sudden or unexpected. It's possible that she died in the influenza epidemic that raged during those years. Barbara Harris has said that actually the number of noble women who die in those middle 1550s years is quite extraordinary and might suggest that they were hit pretty bad by that epidemic. But we don't know for certain. 1555 is slightly on the early side for that.
So it's a bit sad.
She kind of fizzles out. This might also be because by 1555, Mary I is on the throne. And of course, for someone of reformist beliefs like our Mary, you want to keep your head down during that time.
Yeah, absolutely. The winds of change have certainly blown by that point. But she is, there is her, whether she's in it or not, I've actually spoken to the folk at Framlingham Church where the tomb of Henry Fitzroy is. And whether she's actually in that tomb or not, we don't really know, do we?
No, it's not certain. I think she probably is. Certainly, I think there's an effigy of her in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, St Michael's Church, Framlingham is usually given as her burial place alongside her husband, Henry Fitzroy.
So that's one place to go and see if people are interested in following the footsteps of this Mary, Mary Howard. Are there any other places that are specifically associated with her, or have they all been lost?
Most of them, unfortunately, have been lost. I mean, you could go to Framlingham Castle. She will have spent time there.
Yeah.
Or to Hampton Court, because she would certainly have spent time there as well. But yeah, because most of Henry's palaces don't survive, and things like Kenning Hall doesn't really survive, there aren't a huge number of places that are directly associated with Mary.
Well, I mean, thank you for all of that. That was such a fascinating chat. And actually, I always really loved her and was intrigued by her. But now we've spoken, I'm even more blown away by how interesting and formidable she was as a character and as a woman, as you say, as a force of nature of her time.
Yeah, I think she's pretty amazing. Yeah, she's a subject in my next book as well, hopefully.
Ah, good. Well, can you tell us anything about that book?
Well, it's only in its very early stages, and I don't have any firm details at this point, but it's going to be about the women who served Henry VIII's wives as ladies-in-waiting.
Well,
Mary was one of those. I'm going to put her in because she's very cool.
Yeah, she is cool. And there'll be a lot of people who will be very interested in that. So, all I can say is thank you so much, Nikki. That was amazing.
Thanks for having me.
What a woman. Gosh, as you heard in that interview, I think I'm now more in love with Mary Howard than I was before, if that is possible. I hope you fell in love with her too. Well, that brings us to the end of this month's Tudor Travel Show. So, as I said before, wish me luck. I should be on the road getting lots of pictures and videos and interviews for your Tudor delight and delectation in the autumn. Fingers crossed that we don't see a second spike and that all my arrangements fall into place. I hope you too have a lovely August, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, and I look forward to seeing you and speaking with you and talking with you again in September. So for now, it surely is. Happy time travelling!